Hello and welcome to the Multiplanetary Society podcast. This podcast explores the how and why of humanity becoming a multiplanetary species, as well as other topics related to space. I'm your host, Timothy Reuter. For our first episode, we are pleased to have with us Alex Gilbert, who wrote a great article in the Milken Institute Review earlier this year entitled "Mining in Space is Coming." Alex, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, so I thought we'd kick things off with just a brief description of who you are. So I'd love to learn a little bit more about you and why you wrote this article.
Yeah, for sure. So I call myself a complex systems professional. So what that means is that I look at the intersection between technology, governance, and markets for natural resource systems. And so I originally started on this because I was a big environmentalist. I was really interested in dealing with climate change. Mm-hmm. And if you care about the environment, you really need to care about energy, because energy has the number one impact on the environment of any human activity. And also, if you care about energy, you need to care about the environment, because the environment's the number one constraint on energy systems. So I started working a lot on understanding how our energy system was designed, how the electric grid works. And after a while, I kind of got drawn increasingly into nuclear power. And that's just because it is our largest source of clean energy in the United States, but it also has some of the greatest policy challenges. So in my day job now, I work on advanced reactor commercialization. So that's the new generation of reactors that we're trying to build, trying to figure out how to make the regulations work, make the policy work. But I've also been working for several years towards a PhD in space resources. The Colorado School of Mines in 2018 began a space resources program and had been working on this for several decades. But essentially, because there was a lot more interest in this, because the sector has taken off, they developed the first graduate program in it. And as soon as I saw it, I was interested. At the time, I was already working as a fellow at the Pain Institute for Public Policy at the Colorado School of Mines, and that was really focused on energy markets and security. But they started working also on outer space and space resource issues on the policy side. And so I applied for the program, started the program just over a year ago, pretty close to wrapping up the classes, and now really starting to focus on the research for my dissertation. So that's really kind of who I am and what brought me here.
Excellent. Well, that's really interesting. And not to go too far down a rabbit hole, but what does one do with a PhD in space mining? Because so far, I don't think it's a huge industry, although it may become one. So what do you think you might do? What are your colleagues in the program thinking they might do?
So that's a great question. I think my colleagues have a much better vision of that than I do. A lot of my colleagues are engineers. The program is interdisciplinary, but it definitely does have a very heavy STEM focus. So a lot of them work at space agencies already. They work in commercial space companies. It's an online program, so it's international. So we have people from space agencies all around the world. There's also some people at Space Force as well. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of the first really public policy dedicated PhD student, so I'm kind of trying to figure out my own path here. Afterwards, I'm not quite sure. I could go into government, I could go into commercial space, but it really depends. But my kind of three research areas that I focus on, particularly relevant to this part of the conversation, is space resources governance. So how do we govern these things? Who owns them? How do we do public policy there? I'm looking also at environmental protection for outer space, which is really in its infancy, but it's critically important that if we start doing industrial activities like mining, that we're aware that we're in a very fragile environment and that we take best practices from other environmental regulation of other sectors. And then finally, just building on kind of my background at the Nuclear Innovation Alliance and advanced reactors, I'm going to be focusing on space nuclear governance issues. So in the early stages of figuring out how do we create a regulatory system to launch commercial space nuclear systems? How do we have technology commercialization and R&D there? And then also, what are some of the big challenges if we end up with, say, like a future like the Expanse, where we have large amounts of fission or fusion propulsion in space? And what does that look like? Are there policy questions there? Or is that something that we can largely leave unregulated? I think it's an open question.
So we are going to nerd out on all of those topics later on this conversation. Last personal question, are you the first person to have a policy-focused PhD in space resource extraction in the world?
No, I think that there are other people that have had PhDs that are similar, and there's also a lot of attorneys in this area.
Okay.
But for this specific program, I know there are some other attorneys and policy people, but I think I'm the first PhD in it. So, and my personal goal is I do want to probably be one of the first people to really specialize in space nuclear governance, because I've been trying hard, but I haven't really been able to find too many people that are doing that right now. So,
awesome. Well, let's dive into the content. So, towards the end of your article, you say that although uncertainties remain high, sooner or later, space mining promises to greatly accelerate space exploration and bolster terrestrial economies. So, you know, I thought this was probably true, but I'd love to hear you unpack. Why do you think space mining is important for the overall space ecosystem?
Yeah, for sure. So I think if you look at kind of the history of space mining, at least in the public imagination, it was really reignited about 5 or 6 years ago with two companies, Planetary Resources and Deep Space Industries. And they were pushing really hard in particular on trying to mine asteroids in outer space. They were looking at precious metals like platinum and gold. And honestly, that's one of the things that really got me to start paying attention to this industry, because I thought that that was a really innovative idea. Mm-hmm. At the time, we were just starting to see commercial space in the U.S. take off, and the U.S. really established its position as a launch leader. And so that led to a large number of policy changes. In particular, there was a bill that the Congress passed in 2015 that made it so that you as a US citizen or company could own a resource gathered in outer space. Now, it didn't set up a regulatory system, which is a huge part of the challenge still, because it's not clear how you actually regulate this or approve this. But it means that if you can get that regulatory system in place, you have guarantee of property rights. And so at the time, that's what the industry needed. Now, those two companies, I think they were very long-term focused. They weren't able to really follow through on that. And so I think that they've either been acquired or otherwise they don't exist as going companies right now. But what things have shifted since then is that we actually are really looking at space resources, but we're not looking at platinum or gold or asteroid mining in particular. And that's because that's really long-term, and it's not clear if bringing that stuff back to Earth makes economic sense. The big thing that people are focusing on, which could be really revolutionary, is actually water mining. And when I tell people this, they always say, don't we already like use enough water on Earth? Like, why are we going to go mine water out in space? And at first it's like, yeah, why would we need to go get water? We're on an ocean planet. It has to do with how the tyranny of the rocket equation work, or really how gravity impacts things. Gravity is essentially a tax on any sort of space activity. It's really expensive to get outside of Earth's gravity. And what we've discovered over the last 15 to 20 years is that the moon has a lot more water resources than we expected. And there's a number of different ways you can try and get water on the moon. One of the big ones is that the craters, especially in the South Pole, have large cold traps where you have conditions that allow you to have frozen water ice. So if you can go there, you can extract that water ice. Now, water is hydrogen, oxygen. If you go ahead and split that using electrolysis, then you can put it back together as hydrazine, which is rocket fuel. Mm-hmm. And then that allows you to refuel in space. And because the moon's gravity is 1/6 that of Earth, it can potentially be much cheaper to get water and rocket fuel made on the moon and put into space and then refuel spacecraft. So already we're trying to reduce the cost of launching a rocket from the Earth a lot. But if you can then launch something up, get past all that really strong gravity, and then go refuel, you can then do so many more types of missions in deep space. You can do a lot more lunar activities. You can do a lot more things in geostationary orbit and other sorts of value-producing things. Ideas like that might sound crazy, like space-based solar power might well become feasible economically. And if you're serious about getting to Mars, it's going to be very difficult to do Mars missions that are sustainable and at scale without some sort of refueling infrastructure. So this is where a lot of the commercial and government focus is right now, is on water mining on the moon. And what we're going to see over, I think, the next 5 to 10 years is companies starting to explore this, setting up initial legal systems and figuring out resource questions. And then I think from there, we'll start expanding more broadly.
Yeah, I think this is one of the things that's a little hard for people to wrap their mind around. Because as you said, originally the idea is, okay, we'll get great stuff, you know, from space and we'll bring it back to Earth. And that's how mining interacts with our lives right now. And really what you're talking about is extraction for an entirely separate economy, right? So you're making it easier to say, get to Mars. But is there any way to think about economic value on Mars that connects to economic value on Earth, or are these sort of totally separate systems?
Yeah, that's a really excellent question. And one thing that often comes up when you talk about this is people are like, why go to space? Like, we got enough problems on Earth. We, like, especially dealing with climate change, these environmental issues, like, we should put Earth first or whatever. I think that is a really, it's a way that a lot of people understand space. But if you actually look at space, I mean, any economic value that you create with a space economy, it's going to accrue on Earth. The jobs that you're producing, the economic value that you're producing, mm-hmm. even if it is a mission to outer space, even if it is a significant activity on Mars, it'll create most of that or all of that economic value on Earth, just because you need to have all the design, all the supporting systems, the governance. And then all the other big thing that I think is important to understand there is that historically the space sector is a technology innovating or forcing sector. We develop technologies there that then spill out through the rest of the economy. And so if you're worried about, say, climate change, like, I work on climate change daily, it's a really big issue that we're trying to solve. And I can tell you that from what I've seen in the companies I've talked to, if we develop space nuclear systems, it actually makes it much easier and potentially cheaper to develop terrestrial nuclear systems. Same thing potentially with next generation solar power, or that space-based solar power I was telling you about. And so because space is such an extreme operating environment, because it has severe radiation, because it has microgravity, because it has major temperature swings, because your energy and mass constrained, there are literally thousands of inventions and innovations that you need to do to have a large space sector, and almost all the benefits are going to accrue back to Earth. And so it's really a matter of, how do we get these new technologies? How do we have a sector that can afford to pay them when they cost a lot? And then later on, once they scale up, they can be low cost for general applications on Earth.
Right. And sort of speaking of costs, how are the economics of this changing? I mean, you know, my understanding of what SpaceX did is originally it actually wasn't technical innovation. It was completely transforming the cost structure of the industry, which no one else was incentivized to do. So how are the costs changing? And when do you think maybe there's sort of an inflection point when it really opens up space-based mining in a new way?
Yeah, so you make a very astute observation, which I think is worth focusing on before we get to the technology. I think when people look at space, they really just focus on, hey, the technology has changed and it's doing this. Economic systems are not just about technology. They're also about the commercial and business structures, as well as government incentives and programs. So one of the big things that SpaceX was able to do is they're able to take advantage of an early wave of innovation at NASA, which is now kind of the standard operating procedure at NASA, which was really focused on using the commercial sector to develop technologies in a way that was cost effective. And in particular, what SpaceX did is they said that we want fixed price contracting. And this is really into the minutia, but one of the big issues we've had with federal procurement over the last several decades of new technologies, and this is especially bad in the defense sector, but we see it across a lot of federal activities, is they've been using cost plus, that essentially you have a contractor, they win a contract, and then they are, instead of getting paid a specific amount for that contract, they're reimbursed for the cost plus some set profit margin. And if you think about this for a few minutes and you want to be a greedy capitalist, you immediately realize, I make more money, I increase my profit margin, the more expensive my product is.
Yeah.
And so it just creates an industry and structure and incentive to not focus on reducing costs as much as possible. One of the things that SpaceX did that was different with federal contracts is they insisted on fixed cost. Instead of saying that we're going to have this like our profit based on what you can get us for that cost adder, we're going to sell you a rocket at, say, $50 million or $100 million. And that's the price that you're going to pay no matter what. And then our profit depends on us delivering that rocket and also figuring out how we can do that at lower cost. And so they create an internal structure that incentivized reducing costs as much as possible. Now we can get to the technology side. So when you get that kind of structure first, you need to have those type of structures and those business models in place. Then the technology can really matter. And I think they did two things. One, which everybody focuses on and is really important, is reusable rocketry. and you build this big rocket, you're not going to just use it once. You're going to land it. You're going to be able to refuel it again. You have to do some sort of refurbishment and other maintenance, but you are able to reduce a large part of your capital costs associated with a launch. And so then it closely becomes tied to how much fuel you're using, which is a lot of fuel, but it's not a huge part of the overall cost. The second part, which is important and is not as well understood outside of the space industry, is the use of off-the-shelf components. What does that mean? Historically, because it was so expensive to get things to space and space was a harsh operating environment, you need to have very specialized equipment and electronics and other things to operate in the space environment. You didn't want to, don't want to risk your $200, $300 million mission because you have a satellite that fails because there's some small electronic issue. Because you can reduce the cost of accessing space in the first place with reusable rocketry, that cost for a mission goes down significantly. And so you're able to use not necessarily lower quality, but consumer grade materials and other sorts of products in a spacecraft. And so if you're able to use, instead of having a very specialized computer, a normal computer, that allows you to reduce the cost of the spacecraft itself. And SpaceX also did that to a certain degree with some of their rocketry production. Another thing they did that a little bit, it's how they decided to do things. I think it was important at the time, is they did horizontal and vertical integration. They brought as much in-house as possible. Right. And I think that was in part due to how the industry operated at the time is a little bit more stagnant. Right.
But so, you know, we definitely see costs going down dramatically for especially low Earth orbit launch or, you know, cargo delivery. And presumably some of this will eventually spill over into sort of higher launch trajectories. Is that the only cost that needs to get down, getting your mining robot to the asteroid? Or is there a whole set of other costs that need to go down, and sort of not to compound questions too much, but it seems like we've, you know, now reached a point where satellites can be a purely commercial endeavor. It used to be something that only governments did or funded, you know, with parastatals doing the work. But now there is a genuine commercial sector where no government funding is needed. You know, what would it take to get there for space mining, right? Because all of the deep space flights in the short term are going to be governmental. And so they will be the customers for this extracted water that gets turned into rocket fuel. When does this sort of the switch flip and this can become maybe a genuinely or much more private sector activity like what we've seen with satellites?
Yeah, so the big problem historically was just the high cost access space. That's going down. That's going to continue to go down. It probably does still need to keep going down further for some of these ideas to really become economic. The cost of getting to the moon right now is still pretty high. Something like SpaceX's Starship could really be a game changer just in terms of the cost that they're talking about. One other thing that's important is that it's not just SpaceX. Now there's rocket companies all around the world inspired by SpaceX, they're trying to do the same thing. And one thing that I always emphasize when you're looking at a small or new industry like this, you need competition. You need multiple vendors. You can't have one company responsible for everything. Because look, I like SpaceX. As innovative as SpaceX is, in 50 years, it could be like Microsoft. It could be a large incumbent. And you want to make sure that keep having pressures to continue to be the best version of yourself as a company. So that is a prerequisite for anything else. I think we're heading in that direction. So then the question just becomes, how do you develop the technology? And this is kind of the chicken and egg question of space resources. When we get to space activities, NASA really has been on the forefront of technology development and exploration. And I think the way that things are going to develop in the future, if this is to be realized, is that you do need government as the anchor and initial customer. Government can afford to take higher risks because they have higher public goals. Government is going to definitely be the one that's most interested in scientific research in the near term, and they have a significant amount of money that they can fund that. And once you can develop a system that meets government needs, that then can get to a price where commercial entrants are, one, able to afford it, and two, less concerned about risks of performance. And so what we saw really with SpaceX would not have existed if it was just up to private companies to launch satellites on SpaceX rockets. SpaceX came into being because they served a need that was across the United States government, from NASA, from the Department of Defense. They were able to meet that need. And once they met that need, and they're continuing to meet that need today, once they had that anchor client, that opened the door for the commercial sector to follow. That's probably what's going to happen with a lot of these kind of more, what they call new space activities, is you have a government lead that can take that risk. The commercial sector will follow if you can find value. And we could potentially see a relatively rapid acceleration. One thing too here is that the industry is still really young. Space is integral to our economy. If you actually put a value on it, it's provides much more value in more ways than people realize than we pay for. And so when we look at how things could accelerate, the amount of people that could go into the space economy would go up rapidly. And once you have a rapid influx of talent, you also will have a rapid influx of investment. Talent and investment mean opportunity. That's how you get to a commercial runaway market. And that's what could happen.
Great. And let's turn briefly now to the question of technologies and sort of what still needs to be developed to make this possible.
Yeah, so there's a wide variation here. At the most basic level, to go mine something on the moon, you need a shovel. It's a robotic shovel. It's going to be something that like can stand the specific conditions. But if you can just scoop something up, technically you can start maybe building a pile of regolith, which you can use for radiation shielding. Regolith is the dirt equivalent on the moon. Mm-hmm. But going from there, it gets more and more complex. One of the big things that we're trying to figure out right now is how to mine water on the moon, because it is in this water ice form. The areas that it's in are usually going to be in craters. They're so super cold. This is one area I'm really interested in because the big challenge here is energy. And so you can potentially access solar energy on the moon, but for the crater specifically, you will have to figure out how to transmit it, which is going to be potentially expensive. You might need to have power beaming technologies like laser or microwave beaming to go from a solar set to the mining vehicle. A lot of the ideas that they have is really just to heat up the ground. And because the water's in there, once it's heated, it becomes a gas and you can collect it and you'll have relatively pure water. There could be other volatiles in there that you might want to get depending on what you're doing. One interesting thing about the Starship in particular is that it's methane fuel. It's not hydrazine. So that means that in addition to hydrogen and oxygen, you also need carbon. There's some dry ice in parts of these craters we expect or suspect. So that could be something that you would need to have a processing system to get that out. One of the other ideas that a company is pursuing with some support from NASA is actually for near-Earth asteroids, a relatively small asteroid that has a lot of water in it. You could essentially just cover it in a big bag and then heat it up and the water will come out and you'll be able to extract it. So the best way to really think about it is that think about all the different technologies that we have on Earth and all the life cycle and supply chains to get a specific material. We'll have to largely replicate that in space. So I have to go from, you'll have to have a traditional kind of mining approach. You have to do prospecting to make sure that an area is actually has the right materials that you're looking for and in the right form. You have to figure out what the ore grades are of whatever you're looking at. You have to send the technology there to actually extract it. You have to process it. You have to make sure that it gets to whatever sort of end use that you're trying to get to. And so there's a whole bunch of technologies that could be involved there. One of the things that I think is interesting more recently is some of the terrestrial industrial companies that work on industrial mining or other sorts of equipment on Earth are starting to look at space resources because they see that their technology with certain adaptations could be applied in this situation. So there's a whole bunch of startups. We also might have some incoming companies coming in on this.
And just, you know, how far away are we from this? Is it there's stuff about physics we need to discover, or is it we need to just try out a lot of different stuff and it's sort of a tough engineering problem, but we have the fundamental knowledge we need?
Yeah, so I think there's two things that we need to figure out. We need to figure out the science of the resources, and then we need to figure out the technology and engineering of how to get them. Now, the science for certain things is getting much better. So water is a really good example because we are getting a much better idea of what the surface water looks like. We actually don't know how deep it goes, even on these locations on the moon. And so that would be a huge question we want to answer on the prospecting side. But even more broadly, we have a lot of open questions about the type of elements and minerals that we're looking for. One thing that drives me nuts in this area is every now and then I'll see like a very like CNN or a very high level, like well-read outlet that talks about how Psyche 16, which is a really massive metallic asteroid,
it's worth
is
more worth than the entire economy of the
quadrillions planet. Of dollars. We actually don't know what the composition of Psyche 16 is. We know what its mass is, and it definitely is consistent with potentially being the center of a planetesimal, meaning it has a very metallic or metal-rich core. We don't necessarily know what those metals are, and most importantly, we don't know what form they're in. Just because you have, say, platinum or gold or iron or whatever in a specific mineral doesn't mean that it's easy to get out. Doesn't mean that's easy or it's at an ore grade that you can even process economically. And if you actually take that valuation that they're doing, like this asteroid's worth whatever, apply that to the Earth is worth many, 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 many more times than that. It's just that it's stuff we can't access because it's miles below us. And so there's this kind of, there's a tension between, like, I think the more popular version of what this is and where the science is right now. And one of the things I think is really exciting about this is that to be able to do large scale space mining activities, we're going to have a boom in planetary science. You're going to have more planetary scientists than we know what to do with. There's so many things that you'd have to figure out and be able to understand and so many missions that would need to be done. And then the second thing is figure out the technology and the engineering. And I think that that's something that we have a strong basis based on what NASA and private companies are doing right now for kind of the initial technologies. But the big thing is really getting things to scale. And so an interesting kind of thing that I appreciated recently in doing some more research, NASA developed this system called Technological Readiness Levels, TRLs. If you work with people in the aerospace industry, TRL is one of the most common acronyms all the time. And it's a really good way to say, hey, here's a specific subsystem or component or overall system, and here's where it is in the stages of maturity. It might just be literally a drawing on a piece of paper, TRL 1, all the way up to a flight-tested system that's in space and operating, TRL 8 or 9. The TRL scale ends at 9 for at least the traditional NASA aerospace scale, and that's when you have a system that's operating in orbit. If you look at the energy sector tried adopting this, but what we realize is that TRL 9 is the end of the first valley of death for a new technology, but it's also the beginning of the commercial valley of death to actually get a technology to scale.
Right.
So what the International Energy Agency did, along with other researchers, is they extended the TRL scale to add TRL 10 and TRL 11, with TRL 11 being a commercially available mature technology at scale with established supply chains. So that's one of the big things technologically. It's not just a matter of having the technologies. It's that we need to change the mindset from just having the technologies to being able to get to economic things at scale, to have these space technologies reach TRL 10, TRL 11. At TRL 11, if we reach TRL 11 with a lot of space mining technologies, it will be a completely different space economy. It will at least be $1 trillion, potentially $2 to $5 trillion by the end of the century.
And of course, there's that famous line from, I think, Tyson, that the world's first trillionaire will come from space mining. Shifting gears a little bit, let's go to one of your real areas of expertise. So what are the relevant governance mechanisms? And if you could sort of take us on a little bit of a journey, starting with the international agreements of the 60s through the Obama and Trump administration, how has that developed?
Yeah, for sure. So one of the important things to understand about the history of kind of how the international space and actually generally international governance regime developed is it was during the Cold War. When countries first started launching satellites, first the Soviet Union, then the United States, it was very much an area of competition. And it was also an area of concern because we also just developed nuclear weapons. So the genesis for the Outer Space Treaty, which governs how states relate to each other in outer space, is actually as much an arms control treaty as it is a territory or economic or scientific treaty. The Outer Space Treaty forbids the stationing of nuclear weapons or other weapons of mass destruction in outer space. It forbids military bases on celestial bodies like the moon. In hindsight, I mean, this is negotiated and written in the 1960s. It's a pretty revolutionary idea because we could see that space militarization, even though it is a major part of military planning and strategy, might be somewhat limited by at least how this system was designed. So that's just an important context. When we get to the resource questions, though, that's where things were kind of left out of the treaty. Because at the time, 1960s, the idea of mining the moon is pretty far out there.
And so
this was negotiated internationally, and the Outer Space Treaty is largely silent on the question of, can you specifically mine the moon as a commercial company? It has other provisions, though, that inform that. And the biggest one is that because it wanted to prevent a land rush in space, it forbids national appropriation of celestial bodies. What does that mean? It means that this is not the age of discovery. You can't go to the moon, plant your flag on it, and say that the moon is owned by the United States or whoever. So you cannot, as a country, have sovereign jurisdiction over any celestial body. Now, the legal question that has emerged since then is, sure, you might not have it something as part of your national territory, but can you use resources there? And that's something that the U.S. has taken a specific interpretation that if you go to the moon, you can set up a base. You don't own the land underneath the base, but if you dig some water out, you have that water. That water is no longer part of the celestial body. It's not in place anymore. And it's just like if you were to go out and establish a mining claim somewhere, by taking that action of extracting it, you own that specific resource.
Although, could I walk up to your base and sort of like dig a little bit under it and take out some water that way? Because you don't technically have any sovereignty over the space you're occupying.
So as long as you are not directly interfering in my with my operations, then that's okay. So if you dig underneath my base, that's actually a risk for my base. My base could collapse or something like that. But if I'm digging something and I'm digging in a line and you go further down where I'm digging and you start digging and doing your own activity there, there's nothing to stop you under international law. You're as entitled to go do that as I am. And so that is where things kind of, rubber hits the road, where you could potentially have a lot of friction, because you have this situation where you don't have clearly established ownership before you actually extract a resource. And you could have if there's joint interest in an area, that creates the conditions for state-on-state disagreements. Now, the Outer Space Treaty and the General Space Framework does encourage states to work these issues out. And that's one of the things that we're trying to figure out right now, is how do you create the legal mechanisms to facilitate those conversations?
So I am going to ask for your recommendations, but let's actually do a little more of the storytelling. So we've got these treaties from the 60s, which are still all we have in terms of an international framework. But then the Obama administration has some idea, or does it start with, when do we start getting more sort of creative work on this in the United States? And how has that evolved between administrations?
Yeah, so one more bit of context to help out before I get into that is, right after the space treaties were concluded, we were also working on the other treaties for the global commons, namely Antarctica and the deep seabed under the UN Convention Law of the Sea. And the Antarctica Treaty has a specific prohibition on resource activities. The UN Convention Law of the Sea establishes that areas that are outside of national jurisdiction, so outside of either national waters or your exclusive economic zone, are subject to international governance under the International Seabed Authority. So this is like deep sea mining, which is also blowing up right now. But that has a specific system involved that the U.S. didn't agree to because it had international control over resources. There was a similar treaty proposed for outer space, like the UN Convention Law of the Sea, that would have had international governance mechanisms for outer space resources, called the Moon Treaty. It had a number of other provisions, and it was really kind of like an outer space treaty 2.0, some of the implementation details. That treaty had a number of signatories, but it was largely rejected by the international community, including the United States. So this is kind of a tension now that we've had for the last several decades, is that the Outer Space Treaty clearly is established international law. The Moon Treaty was rejected and had this scheme of an international system. And so what happens between the two of those ideas? And so when we're looking at national questions of policy now, we very clearly as a country have decided that we're not going to sign the Moon Treaty. We do not want international governance of these resources. So in 2015, I always forget the specific acronym, but the bill that was signed into law establish the U.S. idea that if you extract outer space resources, once they're extracted, you then own that resource. If you're a U.S. citizen or a U.S. corporation, that was signed into law by the Obama administration. That was a bipartisan vote. The Trump administration subsequently did a lot of work on space activities. They did an executive order that essentially doubled down on that and reestablished that the U.S. Does not believe that the space resources should be governed in an international system. And they went a little bit further, and they did a very important negotiation called the Artemis Accords. So the Artemis Accords, there's a lot of, I think, controversy or misunderstanding about the Accords. The U.S. was the central negotiator for the Accords, but the Accords are a multilateral treaty between, I believe, 11 countries now, and it's continuing to grow. And the idea there is, instead of the Moon Treaty approach, the Artemis Accords are attempting to figure out how states can work together to explore the moon and explore other areas in outer space in a way that's equitable, that's fair, that benefits everybody. And also, it has specific provisions that states that sign on the Artemis Accords recognize the rights to have space resources. So a lot of countries that are trying to be leaders in space resources, like tiny Luxembourg or United Arab Emirates, have signed on to the Accords because they see this as an international vehicle to legitimize their attempts under national law. And this also justifies the U.S. claims under international law. So that's where we're heading right now. The big issue, though, is that this was a U.S.-led treaty, and the U.S. is in strategic competition with Russia and China in the space domain and other domains as well, but in the space domain particularly. And that's an area where the U.S. wants to retain its leadership and its primacy. So Russia and China are not invited currently to join the Artemis Accords. And so you potentially have competing resource systems in outer space. And to a degree, there is a rush right now to get to the moon to start mining and start doing these activities, because then you can start figuring out and establishing the customs or norms that will then govern everyone else in the future.
So if Vice President Harris, who is chairing the Space Council, came to you and said, Dr. Gilbert, or soon to be Dr. Gilbert, you know, what should we do in this area in terms of governance and coordination? What would your recommendations be?
That's an excellent question. First, the Artemis Accords approach, I think, is solid. And I think that we should remain committed to it and try and get as many countries to join on as possible. I'm not sure necessarily about having China or Russia join on, just because I think that that would be a really hard lift with the way that U.S. policy is right now. But I think you expand the Artemis Accords, you build upon the principles there. There's a lot of things we need to figure out on the implementation. Nationally, though, the biggest thing is we need to figure out a regulatory system. So under the Outer Space Treaty, it requires that national activities, including by commercial actors, be subject to authorization and continuing supervision by the relevant launching state. So what that means is that the U.S. has to both authorize and supervise activities of government and commercial missions that are launched in the United States. When it comes to space resources, we have authorization for launching something. We don't necessarily have a clear regulatory system to authorize and oversee a space resource activity. Now, the U.S. is leading here right now because NASA did a solicitation to have several companies essentially pick up some regolith and sell it to NASA in place. Mm-hmm. That would be the first space resources transaction. Those were originally supposed to happen by 2024 or 2025. That might happen next year. Some of these companies are moving really quickly on this. Wow. And so that would be a proof of market and a proof of legal concept. But what's happening there is that's a NASA-approved mission. So NASA is acting as a de facto authorizer and supervisor under international law. The U.S., for purely commercial interactions, doesn't necessarily have a clear regulatory system for how do you do that for just private entities moving forward. There's a huge debate right now about this idea of mission authorization. Should we even have some sort of framework? There's a lot of opposition to establishing any sort of regulations that could slow down U.S. companies in space, because we are happy with how quickly innovation is happening. And from my perspective, there's two camps. There's regulation is bad, it stops private activities, and then there's regulations needed because it protects the public. And I think you need to go in the middle. You need smart regulations at the right size that retire business risks, that establish clear regulatory pathways, and make sure that the public is represented in these discussions. Because ultimately, if you have a U.S. company up there mining things, the U.S. public is liable for any bad activities that happen. That's how the international regime works. So there's reasons that we want to have this regulatory framework in place. And I'd say that that would be the top priority. One of the challenges right now is just a jurisdictional one. which agency should be responsible for that. Traditionally, the FAA has handled a lot of these things, or the Department of Transportation. Department of Commerce under the Trump administration was proposed to take that over. So figuring out that question, I think, would be a really good priority for Vice President Harris or the National Space Council.
Great. And I look forward to you being put forward as the nominee in the next 5 years to lead the new agency that will focus on that. A few sort of shorter questions towards the end of our time together. When do you think we will see not just a experimental proof of market, but activities at some sort of small scale begin?
I think there's a high likelihood by 2030. And so this ties in with overall U.S. plans. The U.S. Has the Artemis program to send U.S. astronauts back to the moon. They would potentially establish a base on the lunar surface. If you have any sort of major cislunar, meaning activities around the moon and beyond direct Earth orbit activities, it makes potentially a lot of economic sense to start doing some of these things. And so one thing that could be really big is that SpaceX was selected as the human landing system for at least the first of the crewed Artemis missions. And so if you send a SpaceX vehicle there, you might have incentive eventually to start refueling it on the surface so you don't have to bring down all that fuel that you need to launch again, just because that becomes really uneconomic. And so 2030, you could start seeing these systems actually get to real products and at scale. I think you also could see some other things on a much more micro scale, kind of like the NASA solicitation. I mean, that's going to happen within the next 2 or 3 years. And so that will be the first technical space resource. But I think in terms of something that is a part of a mission plan that really integrates in well, we could see that before 2030.
Great. And what do you think are the lessons of sort of the rise and fall of space extraction between, you know, 2015 and 2018, 2019? What can we learn from that brief, glorious period?
Yeah, I think a few things. One, first, the people involved with those companies have some good perspectives on those things. Part of the issue is just that the investment timelines didn't quite line up, that their way to get to market, they knew it was going to take several decades. And so they were working on interim technologies that they could then market. And actually, I think led to the reasons they were acquired was for those technologies. I think the other thing is that it's not just about technology or vision, it's about everything else involved. Some of the biggest questions that I see unanswered here are economics and governance. The systems that we set up around these type of activities, those are really big holes right now. And I think that when it came to those ideas specifically, I don't think that they were necessarily sound from a pure scientific or economic perspective. The economics in particular were really challenging. If you go and you get something like platinum, the reason they were targeting it is that platinum in terms of mass has a very high value. So the idea was that that's really a good resource in space because you're mass constrained. It's really energy intensive to transfer anything. And so you get the most value by having something that has a very low amount of mass compared to its overall value. The problem, though, is that there's not a ton of platinum in the world. I think if you actually look at it, if you have a small house by volume, that's larger than all the platinum in history that we've mined. Wow. And so, yeah, a lot of these markets, when you look at them, the amount of volume actually involved is not huge. And so if you bring a space mined convoy or delivery back to Earth, you'll crash markets. And also markets are going to crash before you even leave the space celestial body, because you'll be able to know that those markets or those deliveries are on the way. And so the way that markets respond to return to Earth, I don't necessarily see that as making sense anytime soon. I also think there's some interesting environmental questions about what would happen if you did reentry at scale.
Not even for H3?
Helium-3 is interesting. It might not. A lot of people in the space industry see it as a red herring that everyone talks about and gets excited about it. At best, it would be a resource in the latter half of the 20th century for advanced fusion reactors. We don't necessarily even have basic fusion right now, so it's really a long-term resource. What's interesting is if you look at helium-3, it's one of those situations where countries are citing helium-3 as why they're going to the moon. And it's kind of a convenient justification. We're going to get this really exotic thing that's really hard to find on Earth. You can only get it in space, but you can't really use it right now. Having a lot of that, I think, is it's really hard just to even get it on the moon. It's not in great concentrations. So if you are going to have some sort of return to Earth scenario, you need to have something that's relatively exotic that can only really come from space and that has high value per mass. You could have things like manufactured products because you can use microgravity to manufacture certain things that you can't do on Earth. So that could be a big area. But realistically, I think the lesson from the 2015 to 2018 timeframe is that we need to further develop the whole ecosystem of resource extraction here. So the economics is a part of it, not being able to get investors fully on board because that was a hard story to tell. But really to have a successful activities and space resources, you need to have economists, you need to have lawyers, you need to have businessmen, you need to have supply chains working, you have all sorts of engineers, not just aerospace engineers, mechanical engineers, potentially nuclear engineers. There's so many problems that need to be solved. And the bigger that the overall space ecosystem and industry get, the more likely you are to be successful. And so you really need to have things timed to the overall growth of the industry to really capitalize on those opportunities.
Right. And last question, what are some companies or people that you think are leading in this sector? Who are some other people I should talk to for this podcast?
Yeah, for sure. I would highly recommend the Space Resources Program. My professors there are all leaders in individual parts of what they're working on. So they really know a lot of their stuff. A lot of the students in the program, too, are leaders because they're attracted to that program from whatever space agencies that they're at. One thing that could be really helpful would be to get a sense of what happened at the National Space Council during the last administration and this administration. That was a really big change because it was a clear indication that guiding federal interagency cooperation on space was a executive level priority, but also gave a mechanism for a lot of those agencies to really work out many questions. And so there were many space policy directives that came down during the Trump administration. The Biden administration is largely going to embrace them. There's been a lot of carryover because those were not really ideological. They were not partisan. They were based on the best interests of what the agencies thought. And so that would be a really interesting area to explore. NASA would definitely be a huge portion of this too. They are going to be the number one space resource purchaser anytime in probably the next decade or so. I don't really see that changing. If there are these kind of water refuelings in space, it's going to be NASA that gets them. And then I think finally, just having a better understanding of the launch side of things.
Who are some companies that you would recommend I talk to?
Let's see. iSpace is a leader. I believe Maxar is working on some things. You've got, I can never remember the actual company. Yes, TransAstra. TransAstra is working on things. They've got their Honeybee. Those would definitely be some of the leaders that I would look at.
Is there anything else that you think would be of interest to our audience?
One thing I think, especially kind of the theme of multiplanetary species that is really big is kind of focusing on the equity issues and a lot of the debates around that. I know that that's it's a really tough debate in all industries right now, but especially in space, it's a huge issue because you have a lot of aerospace engineers that have traditionally dominated the space that are also white and male and also maybe more conservative and leaning. And so some of them like straight up don't believe that's an issue. They don't understand why people are like, you shouldn't call it colonization, you should call it settlement. Or there's so many people that still say manned. I really hope I didn't do that on the podcast. I try to make sure to stay crude. So having some people that can talk about that, there's a lot more people that are willing to kind of go on the record and talk about those issues now. Because especially like, I think that there's the libertarian view. We're going to settle Mars and it's going to be perfect. But I think if you actually had all the libertarian bros on one colony, it would be pretty toxic and would end pretty quickly. So if we are to become a multiplanetary species, we're not running away from our problems. And I think that that's a huge part of it. There's like this space escapism that things are so terrible here, I'm just going to go in space and escape all that. If you're going to space, you're bringing that with you, whether you know it or not. And if you have any sort of communities in space, you're going to have your own issues. And so really kind of exploring as we start heading into this area, how does what's happening in the space sector and broader social conversation around justice influence all that?
That's a perfect note to end on. Thank you to Alice Gilbert for agreeing to be the first guest on the Multiplanetary Society podcast. I'll put a link to Alex's excellent article in the show notes. And thank you to all our listeners. If you like this content, please make sure to subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform to ensure you don't miss an episode. and leave a review to help other people find it. If you have any feedback or guest suggestions, please feel free to email us at multiplanetarysociety, all one word with no dashes, @gmail.com. Thanks again, and I look forward to seeing you on the next podcast.